Good evening, I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
You're watching Consider This, the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Now, tonight we have a one-hour special edition of Consider This to discuss Budget 2021, which was tabled in Dewan Rakyat earlier today. We're going to be hearing from different MPs and experts, and also our colleague Ibrahim Saini from Notepad with Ibrahim Saini will be joining us in different segments throughout the show to take a look at the different tax incentives that have been announced. Now, our first guest tonight is Sharil Hamdan. He is the information chief of UMNO. Sharil, good evening. Now, were UMNO's ideas and suggestions taken into consideration in this budget? I'm just wondering because, you know, while you support the Perikatan National Government, I'm wondering whether this budget reflects your party's thinking about what the government should be doing at this juncture of the pandemic and the global recession.
I think in short, yes, there were elements in the budget that reflected specific requests that the party asked for, or at least representatives of the party did. For example, stuff around the withdrawal from account one of EPF, and perhaps more importantly, the increase in transfer payments to B40. I think those are the couple of things that come to mind. That reflect the spirit of what I think Barisan Nasional pushed for.
Were there any elements, suggestions not taken up that you feel in any way weakened this budget as a budget that was much talked about in terms of, you know, the need for bold ideas?
So definitely there were things that I wish were in there. And on a personal note, I've been pushing for something approaching a job guarantee program, which the closest element in the budget reflecting that was perhaps the short-term contract jobs. I can't, for the life of me, can't remember. MyStep, I think that's what it's called, which approaches the idea of a job guarantee, or, you know, the public sector creating jobs for the unemployed. But I think overall, was this budget bold? No. Was it too weak? No, either. So it's almost in keeping with the incrementalism that Malaysia is used to. So on a personal note, I have some disappointment, but also hopeful that implementation of some of the new initiatives can lead to good outcomes.
So you were hoping for a bold budget, and as many of us were, because this is a time of a pandemic. What do you think stopped the government short from a bold budget?
I think just institutional inertia. To do things that were outside the box in really meaningful ways. And that meant, for example, increasing the deficit far bigger than what it would be now. Doing things like public sector creating jobs or funding jobs for people, which is, again, something that's not, we're not used to doing. Thinking of issuing special sukuk, for example, changing the laws to allow for Bank Negara to subscribe to MGS, for example. As long as the expenditure is useful and addresses the two biggest needs of the public right now, which is cash assistance and jobs.
Okay.
So unemployment and transfer payments are the two biggest things I think we're faced with. And this budget approaches those problems with incrementalist measures, which is okay. But it's not groundbreaking.
All right. Well, since, you know, you pointed out that as long as the expenditure is useful, can you weigh in on the fact that there's been some outrage over the increase in the allocation for JASA, the once defunct Special Affairs Department? It was 30 million in 2018. Now it's 85.5 million ringgit. That's a 185% increase. What justifies this amount going to JASA, which was once the propaganda unit that housed, I believe, an army of cyber troopers?
Yeah, so first things first, your specific question, why is it raised that much? I have the same question. I haven't seen any details as to why it would have needed that big of a budget. So the government and the ministry will have to, you know, come clean and explain why. In terms of JASA itself, if it remains or if it returns to being a propaganda unit for any party or government, I'm not for it. But if it plays a role that is needed in especially rural areas, doing on-the-ground programs that Jabatan Penerangan perhaps, for whatever reason, aren't able to do, then I think it's okay. But 80 million sounds big to me, off the top of my head.
Yeah, and it's slightly more than actually what 8,000 employees of MAS will get. I think there's a 50 million support for them in terms of retraining and also finding jobs for them. But I want to come back to the jobs issue, Cheryl, since it's really something close to your heart. There was an announcement of a Majlis Pekerjaan Negara, and that's very interesting because, on one hand, it suggests that there's a concern about job creation, because here we see the creation of more bureaucracy, and I don't know what you think of that. I mean, do we need yet another agency?
I miss whether the agency was funded operationally. I hope not. If it's basically just ministers and civil servants getting together in an agency or in a majlis, that's okay. So that wouldn't cost us extra.
But what would they be doing differently? What would you have them do that they don't already do? What would be the remit, however it's funded, you think that majlis should have?
I think it should really think about creating jobs that the public sector funds. If all it's going to do is job matching, if what it's going to do is figure out what the skills mismatch is and do retraining, then I think your critique is fair in the sense that there are already other agencies doing that.
Right.
So why the need for this majlis? It will have a different remit. And if that remit is about identifying where the public sector can fund the creation of new jobs, perhaps in concert with my step, then that makes a bit of sense. But again, details are thin at the moment.
Yeah, I want to ask you very quickly, Cheryl, about whether this was a young people-focused budget. I know there have been some incentives, some transfers announced, but is this going to actually help young people in the areas that they need it the most?
So there's a long list of transfer payments, which I think is a return to the pre-PH days. So that's that bit that I think you'll find many BN supporters or BN leading folks are quite pleased about. And in that list of transfer payments, there are those that are quite specific to young people. But still, the biggest problem now is jobs. I'm not sure the Majlis Kerja, I'm not sure if my step with 50,000 jobs is going to cut it. So until and unless the implementation of this Majlis Pekerjaan leads to a reduction in unemployed graduates and unemployed young people, we can't say it's a success yet.
Cheryl, where would you like the conversation to go in terms of job creation? So let's say you were the Prime Minister and you had the right to kind of get government funding and creating jobs. Where would you create them? In an economy where the tourism sector has been obliterated, there are a lot of young people in there. Aviation is obliterated, a lot of young people there too. Where would you create jobs? What kind of jobs?
First principle, number one, is save workers, don't save jobs. That's something we have to come to terms with. Yeah, sometimes you've got to save industries, sure, but where they cannot be saved in the immediate term, it's really the workers that matter, right? So this retraining thing that they're doing with airline and tourism workers, fine, let's see where that goes. But to your question, what would I do? I do the job guarantee. Where would I focus money on? I'd focus on building a more caring economy, and I'll focus on building a more green economy. And I'll create jobs that the private sector wouldn't otherwise create. So care economy could be something as simple as increasing elderly care for B40 and low-income families, so that it's not just rich elites who get to hire private nurses who come to the house when you have a sick elderly person in the house, right? So many times we've seen low-income families who have one parent who is maybe a stroke patient. The child will have to quit the job to take care of the parent. And I've seen this many times in my area.
Right.
So little things like that, And then more, perhaps more exciting things, how do we ensure the green economy becomes a norm in this country the next X number of years, say 10 to 15 years? There needs to be public funding in a big way to make buildings greener. Any number of things around the environment and the green economy, which I think would justify a big fiscal injection, not just to create new jobs and therefore aim for zero unemployment, which we should, but also rebuild the kind of economy that Malaysia deserves.
Cheryl, thank you so much for speaking with us tonight. We appreciate your time. Now we're going to speak to another MP on the other across the aisle. We're joined now by Wong Chen, MP of Subang. Wong Chen, I know it's only been a few hours and everyone's still digesting all the announcements that were made, but let's talk about initial reactions. Did this budget take into account the proposals put forth by the opposition?
I think it partly did. I mean, they made mentions about mental health, better treatment for women, domestic abuse issues. So those were some of the things that we touched on. But the six key drivers that we wanted the government to adopt, I think you adopted some. But again, everything is up to the details of it. So for instance, we asked him to spend more on development expenditure, on water supply, improving water supply in Selangor, Kedah, Kelantan and Pahang. We also asked for better fiberization of the internet connectivity. But then you go in and look at the budget itself, they've allocated a miserable 3.3 billion for those two areas, plus sewage, plus electricity supply. So until we get a proper breakdown, we can't really say whether this has adopted any of our real recommendations or not.
In view of that, I mean, what does it do for the federal opposition? I'm thinking Pakatan Harapan in particular, their sense of whether they're going to support this budget or not. I mean, was there a deal breaker? Was there something that, you know, that you disagree so much with that it would make you refrain from supporting this budget?
No, I don't think it's a deal breaker. I mean, Guaning has come out and said that it could be a deal breaker, but then later on he went on to say that there are room for improvement, room for dialogue. I don't think that's the issue. For us, we would like to see the details. We use the debate period to really question where are these real, so-called adoption of our proposals. But the real deal breaker at this moment for me is the fact that the revenue model is very iffy and it's too optimistic. You know, the fundamentals of a budget making is you have to be honest. You have to give proper projections of what 2021 could be. And once they've sort of, fixed the so-called revenue model, which is overtly optimistic, then the expenditure, that just makes a mockery of the entire expenditure exercise. So I think that's a more fundamental issue that we have to worry about.
And is that something that you're going to be debating, challenging in the next few days?
Absolutely. I mean, have you seen the corporate income tax data that they are presenting in terms of revenue projection? They're projecting to collect more tax than 2019, pre-COVID. I mean, I've not seen anything as ridiculous as this idea. There are also, 14 billion of assets that they will divest in order to pay for the budget. So you can't go around and say, I want to have the biggest budget ever, expansionary policy on fiscal policy, based on these assumptions which are blatantly not correct, in my opinion, anyway. So I will be picking on those points first and then look at their actual expenditure. What do they want to do? It appears that, I was expecting a COVID-19 budget, which means we spend 40 billion, 50 billion on tackling COVID-19 via wage subsidy, some sort of social assistance handouts and stuff like that, being the bulk. But instead, we got a very small COVID-19 budget. This looks like, business as usual is high OPEX, high DVEX. So I don't see the point.
Considering that revenue is likely to shrink on all kinds of levels for government, where do you think this money that you're proposing they spend, the bigger money, come from? In terms of what kind of borrowings would you like to see the government step up to or be, feel brave enough to get into in order to fund this kind of level of budgeting?
Well, the government is you know, they're restricted in their space, so-called fiscal space, because there is a basic rule they have to apply to, which is revenue must be higher than the operating expenditure, right? So you can go out there and issue 100 billion of bonds or sukuks. You can issue 150, 120, it's up to you, right? There are pros and cons of all this kind of thing, but I think in the COVID-19 situation, you have to expand for sure. But because of the rule that they cannot have revenue less than operating expenditure, the government has sort of come up with some creative style of budgeting. They've created this extra expenditure category, a hybrid of OPEX and DVEX, development expenditure, and they call it the COVID-19 fund, right? I don't have real quarrel about this issue. It's just that when they start projecting silly numbers and expect us to support this thing, I don't think that's right, you know? So please, issue the bonds, issue the sukuks, but then the sukuks and bonds can only be used for DVEX. Come and tell us you want to use it for COVID-19. I support that. But don't come and tell us you want to, you know, pump prime the economy, because normally people spend less than 50 billion on DVEX. This year you want to spend 71 billion? Wong Chen, you're not spending enough on COVID? I mean, come on, this is ridiculous.
Wong Chen, a few days ago we spoke to MP Fuzia Saleh, and she brought up that it's almost always the government of the day gets the budget that they want, the budget that they tabled. Is that the case? Is that going to be the case for this budget? Is this budget already locked in?
Well, the budget can change. There is no doubt about it. But that has to happen at the committee stage, right? But to do a committee stage change, which means each individual ministry goes through a change, is a bit difficult because you need to have a consolidated account eventually. So I think the process for change is quite difficult, but the government can do so, but they have to engage us very quickly. I just don't like the idea that we've been sort of semi-hoodwinked by these big revenue numbers. Then we happily make these fantasy numbers on expenditure and expect us to agree to this. I think it's just wrong, fundamentally.
Do you think that, you know, in the era of coalitions and the fluidity of coalitions that we have now, that we will see a much more vibrant debate in Parliament, much more negotiation, and perhaps the government of the day having to be more responsive to criticism and demands for either transparency, as you pointed out, or a shift in priorities?
I think the negotiations will not happen in the debate per se. It will happen behind the scenes. So they really have to get us talking very quickly, because once the debate starts, it becomes very formal and you can't get things done, because all the speeches go through and then the ministers reply them, then there's no room for negotiation. So I hope that parallel to the debate starting next Monday, that there will be separate negotiations between appointed MPs to represent the parties and try to sort something out so that they can table a white paper amendment before the vote happens on the November 23rd. Having said that, you know, politics keep changing every few days in Malaysia. At the moment, Perikatan Nasional seems to have full support of UMNO, so why do they need us anymore? I don't see the point, you see? Unless, of course, UMNO is not telling them the 100% truth or will not, you know, really support them at the end. That means that we really have to negotiate fast and quick and be honest.
Well, we'll just have to see what develops over the weekend then. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Wong Chen. We appreciate your time. We're going to take quick break, and after this, we'll speak to the former health minister for his take on the healthcare allocation in this budget. Stay tuned.